This ceremony was officiated by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at cmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. This morning we are doing Jukai, which is receiving of the precepts of Bodhisattva vows that are integral to Mahayana Buddhism and are integral to all of Buddhism in the sense that the Buddha said that all of Buddhist training is grounded in the what is sometimes referred to as the discipline, which really is the cultivation of the ceasing from harm and the actualizing of what is good, as is expressed and practiced through the precepts. The calming of the mind, developing stability, equanimity in the mind, samadhi, and wisdom, gaining understanding, direct understanding to the nature of things. And all of this is based in the path of liberation to alleviate suffering. The Bodhisattva vows are to liberate suffering of self and other, recognizing that in one is everything, and in everything there's no duality. And so in Mahayana Buddhism, the idea that we can find a personal liberation, my liberation, is a false view, is a delusion. That we are deluded together and we are enlightened together as one body. And so the Bodhisattva vow is to deliberately and consciously take up those vows as one's own life. And so there are six students who have been training here for varying amounts of time, but all for a number of years at least, and who through their own choosing and their own request, this is not a requisite or even expected part of training. When someone enters into training, they are making a commitment to practice, to develop themselves, to develop their practice of the Buddha Dharma in their life and with their teacher and within the Sangha. Taking on the precepts is, because it's vows, taking on vows is a deeply internal shift and decision that a student needs to make for him or herself, because in doing that, they are saying that they're going to align their life in accord with what is true in terms of how reality works. And in doing that, making that internal vow, which is very powerful, in fact, vow is the most powerful force in a human life, but it also means that we are then really committed to doing that, and so that when we don't do that, when we turn away from that vow, which we will do, that's why we take the vows, that the consequences or the karma of that is heavier because we have made that vow. And so we are not turning away from something external, but we're actually turning away from something internal, turning away from ourselves. And so it needs to be a very thoughtful, conscious, and freely taken commitment, freely given commitment. Okay. And so as we begin, these students will first do a series of vows. And this is to recognize how they come here today and what some of the conditions are that are necessary for a student to arrive at this point. And so first they will bow, do bows to the Buddha on the main altar. And so this is recognizing their original teacher, the Buddha, and the origin of these teachings. And then they will do a series of bows to their parents. And so if their parents are here, they will bow to them directly. If not, they will go into the Buddha hall and bow in the direction of where their parents live or are buried if they're deceased. And this is to recognize their family bloodline, to offer in the bow the expression of gratitude for having received this gift of life. And having been raised in such a way that they were influenced by their being raised by their parents and, of course, many other forces and influences to raise bodhicitta, to seek the Dharma, and to be here today receiving these vows. In Buddhism, the precepts, the teachings of the bodhisattva and compassion is based in the realization of enlightenment, that there is no abiding self. There is no inherent and separate entity or nature or soul or seed that exists within us, which holds in any permanent and continuous form what we think of as you and me, our personhood. And in the Buddha realizing that, he was liberated from the need to build up, protect, defend, gain, lose that personhood. And so selfless compassion, karuna, is the compassion that arises naturally from that realization. And now the Buddha vows to the preceptor, the precept teacher, who in this case is myself. And I always like to say, because you know the formality of the ceremony, that it is a solemn ceremony, because when we take vows, that's not a small thing. You know, we are really changing very consciously in this moment, changing the course of our lives, even though there is a continuity. You're all practitioners. You've been studying these precepts and striving to live by them for some time. All of us, as we enter into training, are immersed in chanting the four vows of the Bodhisattva, as we do each day. But taking the vows is a different thing. So in this moment, in this, what's happening right now, something is changing. And that is both has a solemnity to it, because it's a real thing, and because you're creating karma by doing this, and it's also a wondrous and joyful occasion, because when anyone takes vows in something that is good and true, and that arises out of a magnanimous heart, and the desire to be a benefit to the world, to bring good into the world rather than confusion and chaos, that is a cause for celebration. So first we'll do the invocation of the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And as we spoke about at the beginning of the week, there is no Buddhism without Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. There is no bodhisattva precepts, training, practice, realization. The Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is not only the whole of Buddhism, but it's the whole of this world when we really understand it. It's the whole of you and your life. So Buddha is the original Buddha Shakyamuni, and to take refuge is to unreservedly rely upon, to turn towards, to realize as your own body and mind. And so Buddha is Shakyamuni. It's all enlightened masters, female and male. It's also your nature, self-nature. It's also taking refuge in the example of those before us, that you can do this. Taking refuge in the Dharma is the teachings of the Buddha, all enlightened teachings expounded over the centuries, but it's also the teachings of all phenomena, because all things in this universe, anything we can experience with our senses, itself has self-nature, which is clear and pure and undefiled. The Sangha is the community of practitioners, those seated in this hall today, your Dharma brothers and sisters, those Dharma brothers and sisters all around the world, that you, most of whom you'll never meet, all those who have come before us, who because of their practice we are able to be here today. And so we invoke this grand community of wisdom, real phenomena, and community, Sangha, and bring it into the presence of this time to witness and be present here. And so I'll do this twice in Japanese and once in English. Everyone, please go show. Namo Jipo Butsu, Namo Jipo Ho, Namo Jipo So, Namo Hachi Shakyamuni Butsu, Namo Daisi Dai Hi Kyu Ku Kanze On Bo Sa, Namo Daishin Fugen Bo Sa, Namo Daishin Manjushri Bo Sa, Namu koso joyo daishi, namu taiso josa daishi, namu riki daiso shibo satsu. Be one with the Buddha in the 10 directions, be one with the Dharma in the 10 directions, be one with the Sangha in the 10 directions, be one with our original teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha. Be one with the great compassionate Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Be one with the great wise Samantabhadra Bodhisattva. Be one with the great wise Manjushri Bodhisattva. Be one with Koso Joyodaishi. Be one with Taiso Josai Daishi. Be one with the successive great ancestors. Namu Jipo Butsu Namu Jipo Ho Namu Jipo So Namu Hanshi Shakyamuni Butsu Namu Daisi Dai Hi Kyuku Kanzeon Bosa Namu Dajin Fugen Bosa Namu Dashin Manjushri Bosa Namu Koso Joyo Daishi Namu Taiso Josai Daishi Namu Riki Daiso Shibo Satsu. Now we're all here. Next is the Gatha of Atonement. And this is an important part of our practice, our training, our liturgy, because in the very beginning of the Buddha's teaching life, he recognized that as soon as you set out consciously and turn towards the Dharma, turn towards living a life that is non-killing, non-harming, that is bringing forth good and actualizing good for others, you meet every moment where that's not happening. More so, because now it's conscious in your mind, right? Because our mind is now attuned to that. It's turned towards living our lives that way. And so we become much more aware, much more sensitive, and conscious of those moments when we're turning in another direction. And so the Buddha realized there has to be a way that we attend to that step by step, because otherwise we will accumulate. We'll accumulate remorse and guilt, and that will bind us, it'll cloud our minds, and then we'll fall even more so. Because now we're sort of caught up in all of that and getting further away. And so the Gatha of Atonement is a very powerful practice that belongs to each of us as practitioners, and really, I think, should be an ongoing part of our daily practice, to turn our attention to all the karma that we've created, every thought, word, and action that has been based in some desire, some impulse, karmic, conditioned, that is not generous, that is not infused with loving kindness, that is not clear-minded, that causes suffering for ourselves and others. And to as we do that, to develop the capacity to actually create suffering. Right? It's kind of ironic that in the committed to the path of not creating suffering, we have to learn not get better at creating suffering, but learn how to create suffering in the sense that so that we begin to shift those impulses, those habits, those conditions that foster that. But also when we create suffering for self and other, that we know how to respond. So we don't have to live in fear of what we might think of as making a mistake or transgressing or being forgetful or being selfish. Right? We know those impulses exist within us. We have to learn how to turn them into allies, right? Because then they come closer, and now we learn and we develop ourselves rather than enemies who we want to extinguish or expel, which doesn't work. And so the Gatha of Atonement is actually a way to begin to bring us into very intimate contact with all of our humanity, not so we become complacent to it, quite the contrary, so we become vibrantly aware and learn how to take responsibility. In a way, it's very simple, right? And in the same sense, it is obviously, as we look around the world and this room and ourselves, not so easy. And so how do we do that? The Gatha of Atonement is a teaching and a practice to guide us in this. And so we'll do this in call and echo. So I'll chant each line and everyone is invited to do the Gatha of Atonement. Gassho and Chokyi. All evil karma ever committed by me since of old. On account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance. Born of my body, mouth, and thought. Now I atone for it all. All evil karma ever committed by me since of old. on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance. Born of my body, mouth, and thought. Now I atone for it all. All evil karma ever committed by me since of old. On account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance. Born of my body, mouth, and thought. Now I atone for it all. You know, one of the interesting things about the spiritual journey is that in a day like this, you know, you're taking these precepts in the faith of these teachings, of these precepts, and in yourself. It has to be. In your practice, in what you've learned and developed so far. And yet there are certainly ways at this point in one's practice, and for a long time, that we also doubt. We doubt our capacity. And in a sense, that's why we need to do this. It's empowering. It is an empowerment. And it's an empowerment of your faith in yourself, your capacity, right? Which in a sense, you're constantly practicing into, constantly developing confidence in. Because we begin both in a kind of almost non-rational trust, it's hard to explain, and insecurity together. And so part of this is, you know, recognizing that we have the capacity, the strength, the resiliency to turn towards what is difficult. This weekend has been a living, dynamic expression of that. And that when we do that, right, our fears that we can't do that, or that if we do that, the consequences of that will be overwhelming, we'll realize no, that's not true. None of that's true. Those are our mental constructions, right, coming out of that anxiety. When we turn towards, as the Buddha said, we will need courage, right? But in turning towards, we discover the reality versus rather than the idea. And in that, your faith deepens, your confidence gets stronger, your bodhisattva vow is affirmed, verified. And then you do that again and 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 again. When you no longer need to do that, let me know. I'd like to be the first to know. And I'll let you know when I no longer need to do that. And now, having invoked the three treasures, we will take refuge in the three treasures. As I have said before, that this was one of the first way, I believe, that the Buddha would ordain his monastics. And it is common to all of the schools of Buddhism. It is, without this, this is what we practice. That when we are taking refuge, and as I said at the beginning of this weekend, that what this weekend was about is actively taking refuge. It's not an abstract thing. And it's not a one-time thing. It's ongoing. It becomes your whole body and mind becomes a taking refuge. That when our practice is strong, it's because the three treasures are present and clearly manifesting within us. And when our practice becomes wobbly, right, it's because there's distance between our sense of ourselves and our practice in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so taking refuge is how to actively, dynamically, skillfully revive, refresh yourself. So again, we'll do this in call and response. I'll do it twice in Japanese and once in English. And in English, then there will be the call and response, and everyone is invited to take refuge. Everyone, gassho, please. Namo kiye butsu namo kiye ho namo kiye so kiye butsu mujo san kiye ho riji san kiye so wago san kiye bukyo kiye ho kyo kiye so kyo. I take refuge in the Buddha.
I take refuge in the Dharma.
I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha.
I take refuge in the Buddha, the incomparably honored one.
I take refuge in the Dharma, honorable for its purity.
I take refuge in the Sangha, honorable for its harmony.
I have taken refuge in the Buddha.
I have taken refuge in the Dharma.
I have taken refuge in the Sangha. Namukiye butsu namukiye ho namukiye so kiye butsu mujo san kiye ho riju san kiye so wago san kiye bukyo kiye ho kyo kiye so kyo. Will you maintain this?
I vow to take refuge in the three treasures.
One of the things to look forward to after these important rites of passage is that you will spend the rest of your life understanding what you have done. And that's the good news. Now we will enter into the precepts themselves. First, there's the three pure precepts. The pure precepts describe how to be in the world. Very simply, how does a bodhisattva be in the world? Based in the principle of non-harming and in the intention, the great aspiration to be a benefit to the world. The first pure precept is to not create evil. That tells us that evil, all that evil is everything within the realm of harm, of creating harm. Anything that is destructive, oppressive, life-denying, not nourishing, and working against your awakening, against your liberation, is all within not creating evil. And so this is saying that we created with our thoughts, words, and actions, with our desires, and that we don't have to do that. We can live in a very different way. And so to not create evil is the abiding place of all Buddhas, Chokyi and Gassho. This is the very source of all Buddhas. Do not create evil. We maintain this.
I vow to not create evil.
The second pure precept is to practice good. And so what the Buddha said is that it's not enough just to calm your mind. It's not enough just to gain deep and direct understanding to the nature of things. You must live it. That's the whole of Buddhist practice and Buddha Dharma. It is not abstract. It's not theoretical. How does each of us live our lives? And so practicing good, it's not enough just to not create suffering, but we must also be all about creating good, bringing benefit into the world. And to just, this precept is really saying just in every moment, in every direction, in every encounter, whether someone is present or not, whether anybody notices, if they do, fine, if no, it doesn't matter. Just practice good. Be that way in the world. This is the Dharma of Samyak Sambodhi. This is the way of all beings. Practice good. Will you maintain this?
I vow to practice good.
And the third pure precept is actualize good for others. So in bringing, trying to be a benefit in the world, having that magnanimous heart, caring, very simply, caring. Make sure that that does impact on other people. So that it's not just that we're caring in certain corners, in certain aspects, or towards certain people, but that it's broadcast like rain. It falls everywhere the same. This is to transcend the profane and to be beyond the holy. This is to liberate oneself and others, actualize good for others. Will you maintain this?
I vow to actualize good for others.
Okay, bow. Now, the pure precepts are extremely important, vitally important. They're really the foundation. And as we talked about earlier in the week, there are many times, many things that we encounter where you can't just directly rely upon the great precepts. Because of the complexity, because of the many streams that are flowing into that, because of the fact that whatever action you take, there will be some harm. We live in a complex world, and we have complex lives. We are complex creatures. And so there are many times when you will need to take refuge and turn towards and really develop your understanding of these pure precepts. But there are ways that we as human beings, today and throughout all time and all culture, create the most binding kinds of harm and negative karma. And these are universal truths, and we see them represented in other religious teachings. In Buddhism, because it's non-theistic, this is all about human life. It is singularly about human life, but at the same time recognizing that because of the power of our mind and the reach of our hands, we impact everything, not just the human realm. And so the great precepts bring our attention to those things that we have to pay particular attention to and make our practice here. The first of the great precepts is to affirm life, to not kill, based in that essential principle of not harming, understanding that every creature appears in this world for a purpose. It's here. It has a function. It's in intimate relationship with its environment, its world, and it is intended, its purpose is to fulfill its role. And so to kill, to take away the life of something, is to rob it of that possibility, of that capacity. It's also to, in a sense, desecrate that which is sacred. This is also about not harboring a mind of killing. And here, it's not, we need to understand in terms of taking the life away from life-giving, life-possessing creatures, but also taking the life away from anything. Life is non-killing, Dogen said. The seed of Buddha grows continuously. Maintain the wisdom life of Buddha and do not kill life. Affirm life, do not kill. Will you maintain this?
I vow to affirm life, I will not kill.
Now, because life is non-dual, right, we have to, these precepts are teachings in how to live as non-dual beings, unified beings in a unified world. And so there is the understanding of these precepts that in all moments, in all situations, to the best of your ability, do not kill. But recognizing that as living beings, there will be moments where we do kill. In fact, in every moment, we're taking life from something. And so how do we do that? And so the Mahayana perspective is out of reverence and compassion for life, when necessary to kill, or as you take the life away from something, do that for the benefit of others. And so Oryoki is one of the most important teachings and practices we have that guides us in that. The second great precept is to be giving, do not steal. So this is really developing a non-grasping, non-possessing, non-acquisitional mind, a non-materialistic mind, recognizing that when we try to hold on to something, it's already lost, that when we harbor a mind of taking, that we're not understanding our own completeness. And so it's not seeking contentment or satisfaction in things, in titles, positions, and so on. And then, without that possessiveness, then we can really enjoy things, titles, positions, and use them. Use them for in the service of your own practice, in the service of your liberation. This precept is really about cultivating that mind of generosity. The mind and externals are just thus. The gate of liberation is open. Be giving, do not steal. Will you maintain this?
I vow to be giving, I will not steal.
So that precept clearly relates to not taking what does not belong to us. The next precept, to honor the body, do not misuse sexuality, in a sense, is a particular expression of that. To not misuse sexuality means to not use sexuality that exists within us, whether we're in a sexual relationship or not, because we have sexuality within us, as all living things do. To not use that energy, that force, those desires, those impulses, for harm, but rather to use them for good. To recognize that sexuality is one of the most powerful forces in human life. It can bring us closer together. It can generate great love and affection. It can instill trust and confidence. But it can also create deep, deep wounds. It can create tremendous pain and suffering when it is misused. We see examples of that everywhere. And so to not separate anything about the person, mind from body, from intellect, from emotion, from history, from capacity, and to not separate ourselves from another, to not use our desires, or in a sense be used by our desires to injure another. To honor the body and to not misuse sexuality is to honor the whole person. Honor the body, do not misuse sexuality. Will you maintain this?
I vow to honor the body. I will not misuse sexuality.
The next precept is to manifest truth, to not lie. And this is a very important precept. I mean, these precepts are not ranked. You know, they're all important. It is true that there are some things that we do that, in a sense, can never be repaired. Right? When we take a human life, we cannot bring that person back. But at the same time, all of these precepts create suffering in the world. So to manifest truth, to not lie, is to really saying, don't be afraid of what is true. Understand what is true and know how to live within that truth. To face what is difficult, to not turn away from what is real. And we have to first and foremost do that within ourselves. I mean, isn't that one of the most difficult things about sitting on this cushion? Is facing what we would rather not face, seeing what we'd rather not see, taking responsibility for what we would rather assign to someone else. And so to manifest truth is to bring forth that great courage of the Bodhisattva, to live without deception, because that really is a path of no regret. You know, we're incredibly resilient beings, amazingly so. We can live through amazing things, but regret is a terrible burden to carry. And so too, but we can practice that too. But to not generate that is even better. And so to live without deception is a good path. I live lightly. Dogen says, the Dharma wheel unceasingly turns, and there is neither excess nor incompleteness. Sweet dew permeates the universe. Gain the essence and realize the truth. Manifest truth and not lie. Will you maintain this?
I vow to manifest truth. I will not lie.
It's also important to appreciate that in speaking about truth, it's not that there is some absolute fixed notion. These precepts are not relativistic. It's not just, you know, whatever works for you is real and true. That there are universal truths, but what that means is there are universal recognitions of how the world works. In a sense, it's that. And that when we understand that and live in that way, then we live in harmony. And when we don't, we live in discord. And so to manifest truth is to be understand the way things work, inner and outer. The next precept is to proceed clearly, do not cloud the mind. When we encounter our true nature, our real self, then we understand there is no escape. The idea of turning away is just that, it's an idea. The idea of escaping from our pain is just that. It's an idea and it's an illusion that takes a lot of energy to maintain. And so this precept points to not intoxicating the mind, not making cloudy our natural, bright, clear mind, Buddha mind, but, and also to really examine the moments when we would do that and to use whatever form of intoxication we might choose, obsessive work, obsessive thinking, obsessive entertainment, obsessive anything. And as practitioners, to ask, what am I trying to escape? Everywhere you go, you find yourself. The mind is the originally pure and clear Buddha mind. Do not let it become cloudy. Do not be defiled. Proceed clearly. Do not cloud the mind. We maintain this.
I vow to proceed clearly. I will not cloud the mind.
And this means, you know, in an ordinary life, if somebody, you know, wants to go out with friends and, you know, have a drink, the Buddhism doesn't, prohibit that. In fact, Buddhism doesn't prohibit anything. Right? It just points things out. Right? If we go this way, there's trouble. If we go this way, it's going to be different. But that even in doing that, enjoying ourselves in any way, that we're awake. We're awake. The next precept is to see the perfection. Do not speak of others' errors and faults. The Buddha said that there are four ways that we use speech to create harm. We are deceptive, we speak harshly, we speak divisively, and we speak in a numbing way. So to see the perfection and not speak of others' errors and faults is to make a stranger of another, which is the first step towards aggression and a form of violence. And so, because all oppression, all bias, all racism, sexism, all of the forms of violence that we enact between human beings and within ourselves are based in othering. And the Buddha realized that is the fundamental deception. That is the fundamental illusion. And so, and yet we must be able to speak at times, parents about a child, a teacher about a student, speak critically and recognize where somebody needs help or support or correcting, guiding. But to do that without ill will, without hatred, as I said earlier, to not enjoy speaking of others' errors and faults, to get nothing, no enjoyment from that, but to do that only in the service of helping. In the midst of the Buddha Dharma, we are the same way, the same Dharma, the same realization, and the same practice. Do not speak of others' errors and faults. Do not destroy the way. See the perfection. Do not speak of others' errors and faults. Will you maintain this?
I vow to see the perfection. I will not speak of others' errors and faults.
So I said to these guys earlier in the week, this and the next precept I probably receive more questions about than any of the others, and they almost always relate to work situations. The next precept is to realize self and others as one. Do not elevate the self and blame others. So when there is no self-clinging, then we no longer seek praise or seek to avoid blame. So we're not buoyed up, elated, made to feel good about ourselves in praise, or are confused or crushed in blame, right? We hear what we need to hear. We see what we need to see. We respond. We study. We examine. We learn. We correct our path, right? But without self-clinging, it's a much lighter experience. With self-clinging, it's very, very hard, right? To ride those highs and lows and to avoid the lows and seek out the highs and base our life on that. The Dogen said, Buddhas and ancestors realize the absolute emptiness and realize the whole earth. When the great body is manifested, there's neither inside nor outside. When the Dharma body is manifested, there's not a square inch of earth upon which to stand. Realize self and other as one. Do not elevate the self and blame others. Will you maintain this?
I vow to realize self and other as one. I will not elevate the self and blame others.
You know, and to remember, these precepts are very real. They're about the lives we're living. So that doesn't mean, this precept doesn't mean, you know, that we should not be held accountable for our own actions or hold others accountable. But again, it means to do so without ill will, to do so in the service of compassion, which oftentimes means we have to work towards that. We have to work through our ill will towards that compassion. We can't just leap over when we have that feel anger or resentment or a sense of betrayal. And for perhaps very valid reasons, we can't just leap over those to try and be that compassionate being that we're aspiring to. It has to be honest. The next precept is to give generously, to not be withholding. This is, the other precept was about not taking what doesn't belong to us, and this is about not offering what we have. That in every moment, there is something that we have to offer to everything, to anything. A gesture, a glance, a word, attention, a gift. These are languages everyone understands. To hold on to try not to lose something by clinging to it as having lost it, to let go would then move in accord with things. And in that way, even something very simple can be a very deep and a point of connection, a way of making contact, a giving. So to give generously, to not be withholding. One phrase, one verse, 10,000 forms, 100 grasses, one Dharma, one realization, all Buddhas, all ancestors. That's what you have to offer. Since the beginning, there never has been anything to withhold. Give generously, do not be withholding. Will you maintain this?
I vow to give generously. I will not be withholding.
So that, beginning with that precept, these are the last three precepts, and they express the three poisons and their antidotes. The next is to actualize harmony, to not be angry. The conflict is in the mind. Anger is being in a state of conflict. And so this precept also challenges us to know how to be angry. We have to know how to be angry. In other words, when we're angry, how do you maintain this precept? How do you continue to bring forth compassion when you want to kill somebody? When you want to hurt somebody? Because you're angry, right? Having developed your practice, having mindfulness is the necessary requisite condition. Without that, the mind collapses into anger and is drawn forth karmically and action-wise into that action. When you have developed mindfulness, you can be angry, be aware of that impulse, and know that you're angry, which is very, very different than acting out on the anger. And in that moment, it doesn't feel like compassion, but it is compassion because you're taking responsibility and you're making choices. It is not regressing, it is not advancing. It is not real, it is not unreal. There's an illuminated cloud ocean and there's an ornamented cloud ocean. It's very important. Actualize harmony, do not be angry. Will you maintain this?
I vow to actualize harmony. I will not be angry.
Dogen is pointing there to the basic nature of anger, which we really is ultimately what frees us. But he's also pointing to the fact that it, and that basic nature is that it's empty. But he's also pointing to the fact that in the moment of anger, we are angry. There's a reality to that that we have to honor and pay attention to and practice. The last of the great precepts is to experience the intimacy of thing, do not defile the three treasures. And I think of this as not turning against yourself, against your home, against your world, against the only thing that actually will serve you, the three treasures. And in that is Buddha Dharma Sangha understood within Buddha Dharma, or as we traditionally understand it, but it also is the whole phenomenal universe. And so the defilement of the three treasures is always comes from standing outside, and usually almost always comes from pain, frustration, anger, and turning against rather than into. And so having begun with taking refuge in the three treasures, this last precept brings us back into the recognition of your one true home. Dogen says, living the Dharma with the whole body and mind is the heart of wisdom and compassion. All virtues return to the ocean of reality. You should not comment on them. Just practice them, realize, and actualize them. It's not abstract. It's not theoretical. Experience the intimacy of things. Do not defile the three treasures. Will you maintain this?
I vow to experience the intimacy of things. I will not defile the three treasures.
These 16 precepts, the three treasures, the pure precepts, and the 10 great precepts, have been handed down from Shakyamuni Buddha to Dada Roshi, to me, and now to you. Will you maintain these well?
I will.
Will you maintain these well?
I will.
Will you really maintain these well?
I will.
And now, you know, Dada Roshi is always in this room. And so now I'll offer his words. When the true eye opens, everything is realized as one. When the Dharma eye opens, one is realized as everything. When the true eye functions, it clears away all discriminating thoughts and allows us to see the pure Dharmakaya, the absolute oneness of the universe. When the Dharma eye functions, it creates a clarity that allows us to realize that nothing in this great universe is hidden. Everything is just as it is. The true eye is the eye of wisdom, which is like the sword of Manjushri, cutting through all illusions. The Dharma eye is the eye of compassion, an unconditioned love, the love of the Bodhisattva, of Samantabhadra, of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, that works for the benefit of all beings. Everyone has these two eyes, as does the Buddha, as do you. When we open both eyes, we realize Buddha mind. When we realize Buddha mind, we see for ourselves that self-nature and Buddha nature are not two. Delusion and enlightenment are not two. Falling and standing are not two. This is the treasury of the true Dharma eye. This is giving life to the Buddha. Sorry, one more thing. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay. That's it. Gosh. the list of the ancestors. And that includes both male and female ancestors. Mountains and Rivers Order. This is to certify that Nancy Meyer Emmerich has been fulfilled the precepts, training requirements of Zen Mountain Monastery in the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on this 11th day of November 2018 received the 16 precepts of the Buddha Way, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Esho. The robe of the Buddha. The lineage, ancestors. This is to certify that Constanza Ontaneda, having fulfilled the precepts, training requirements of the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on this 11th day of November received the 16 precepts of the Buddha Way, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Sokyo, the Buddha's robe. Kichmyaku. This is to certify that Steve Myron, having fulfilled the training requirements of the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on this 11th day of November received the precepts of the Buddha Way, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Seigan. Buddha's robe. Kichmyaku. This is to certify that Achang Chen, having fulfilled the precepts, training requirements of the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on this 11th day of November received the 16 precepts of the Buddha Way, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Chusan. List of the ancestors. This is to certify that Jonathan Rosenthal, having fulfilled the training requirements of the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on this 11th day of November received the 16 precepts of the Buddha Way, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Seiko, the Buddha's robe. List of the ancestors. This is to certify that Polly Horn, having fulfilled the precepts, training requirements of the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on this 11th day of November received the 16 precepts of the Buddha Way, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Kiho. Everyone please gosho. When sentient beings receive the sila, they enter the realm of the Buddhas, which is none other than the great enlightenment. Truly they are the children of the Buddha. When sentient beings receive the sila, they enter the realm of the Buddha, which is none other than the great enlightenment. Truly they are the children of the Buddha. When sentient beings receive the sila, they enter the realm of the Buddhas, which is none other than the great enlightenment. Truly they are the children of the Buddha. So now the attendant will lead these new bodhisattvas around the zendo and give everybody an opportunity to offer your congratulations, recognition of their having taken these vows. So now, before we conclude, let me just say a few words about your names. So as is common in many religious traditions, when you enter, you can relax. When you enter into the bodhisattva path by taking these vows, you receive a dharma name, and these are is a new beginning. It's also an offering. It's a teaching. It's a practice. And it evolves, it's alive. Your name sort of goes with you as your own practice develops over the years. So Esho, your name is eternal bloom. A means that which is forever, everlasting, eternal. The Buddha said all conditioned things, everything that we experience, must pass. All things that arise will fall. All things that gather will disperse. This is a fundamental truth. All things are impermanent. What is that which does not fade? What is that which you can rely upon? Because it cannot be grasped. A master asked, what is the fundamental, unchanging truth? And the master said, the flowers on the mountainside bloom like brocade. Sho is blossom, bloom, the most ephemeral, fleeting, fragile, of all things, not something that we think of as eternal. So what was this master saying? Flowers appear, some, when you look at them, seem very simple. Some seem more ornate. But all are just what they are. They don't know simple or complex. They don't know beautiful or plain. Each flower is also a miracle, a wonder, a mystery. It's because it's fleeting that it has so much to offer. It's because it's fragile that it must be taken care of. It's because it is everlasting that it is never apart. Esho, eternal bloom. Constanza, Sokyo. So means simple, plain, like water. Ordinary. We think of ordinary as being, and we think of plain as being uninteresting, no depth. And that's because we're not paying attention. Why is it that almost every religious tradition highly values the virtue of simplicity? Not as a quality, but as a way of living, a way of seeing the world. So is plain like water. It's uncontrived, unadorned. It's your feet touching the floor. It's turning the head. It's taking the hand of the one you love. It's because it is so simple that it is so very difficult to see. It is because it is so unadorned that it is endlessly revealing. Kyo means unbroken thread. It's the character that's used for sutra. It's the thread that binds together the malas. And it's that which binds together what can never be broken. It's a thread that is unified even when it breaks. It's the teachings of the Buddha. It's every enlightened expression. It reveals everything in the night. It is everything in the day. Sokyo is everyday sutra. Steve, your name is Seigan. Sei here originally was used to refer to a person who had knowledge and wisdom, penetrating knowledge and wisdom, and has come to mean sacred and holy, which raises the question, what is sacredness? What makes something sacred? Is it something we do? Is it something that just is? Is it something that can be brought forth and cultivated? Is it something that can be destroyed? Is it something that is sacred in its very nature? And to all of that, I would say yes, a resounding yes. It is everything in and of itself, that is, which is whole and complete. Is there anything that is not this way? Gan is I, sacred I, divine I. And this divinity is that sacredness, which is the realization of the Buddha. In the moment of the Buddha's liberation, he realized all beings are liberated. In the moment that he realized his own completeness, he realized all things are complete. And just imagine the pain of knowing that and seeing so much suffering. And so to cultivate this eye, to have faith in it, from the beginning, that it is already present, it is already clear, it is already functioning. It is only to be realized and made manifest. Seigan, sacred eye. Achong. Ju here is pearl, the many gem. It's the jewel that the dragon at the front door is holding in her claw. You can have that jewel, but you have to get close to that dragon. You have to mess with that dragon. And it will appear as though that dragon is not freely giving of that pearl. That is not the dragon. That is the mind. The pearl arises, is formed by grit, by what we would perceive as dirt. And yet that begins something miraculous, that in that grit, it makes the dragon, the organism, vulnerable, because it's an irritant. It can't be ignored. It has to be responded to skillfully. And in that skillfulness, something wondrous occurs. It is a pearl because of that irritant. San is mountain, the great mountain, the sacred mountain, the home of Manjushri. It is the mountain that we ascend in our training. It is the mountain that we arrive to the peak of over and over again as we encounter the true self. It is the mountain that we descend as we turn into the world and phenomena. And all along, it's never apart. And so, Jusan is Pearl Mountain. Master Genshe once said, the world in all the 10 directions is just one bright pearl. And a student says, I've heard you say this. How can a student understand it? And Genshe said, the world in all directions is just one bright pearl. What use is understanding it? Jusan, Pearl Mountain. Jonathan, your name is Seiko. We have another Seiko in the monastery, but it's a different name, different characters. Sei here is boundless, expansive, limitless. The way is perfect, like vast space, no boundary. It's like the great ocean without any horizon. It moves in all directions. What is this great way that is boundless? Why are these words used to describe you, your nature, your mind, each moment? You know, the language of Buddhism, the language of the Zen tradition is constantly straining, ripping at the seams, right? Exploding, right? Using a vehicle that is intended to confine and define, to express something that is inexpressible, that is limitless. So say is just that. It's already, you can hear it tearing as it expands. Ko means peace, happiness, true happiness, the way itself. Avalokiteshvara saw emptiness of all the five conditions and thus completely relieved misfortune and pain. That is ko. The great way is not difficult. That is ko. It's without conflict. It is serene. It is at ease. It is peace in every step. If we want to bring peace into the world, we have to be peace, which means we have to, as I've said earlier, become very, very adept at our non-peace. Peace is the great fulfillment, and it is not what we think. It is so much more than that. And it is not dependent on our environment. And it is never apart from our environment. Seiko, boundless peace. And Pali, your name, Kiho. Ki is to shine, to be radiant like the sun, spreading warmth and sunlight in all directions, without prejudice, without bias, without hesitation. Not because it wants to, not because it's obligated, it's just what it does. It is life. This light is not separate from the night. And it shows everything to be true. Ki, right, is radiant light. Ho is Dharma, the fundamental law, the nature of things. It also is practice. And so Ho is practice. It's the body of teachings. It's all wisdom practices. Ho is the basic nature of things. It's how things work at their deepest level. And when we live this Dharma, we see that everything that has appeared to be false is true. Kiho is radiant Dharma, which is nothing other than this moment, nothing but your true self. Kiho. (Clears throat) In taking these vows, you have entered into a profound implication. As I said, that you will spend the rest of your lives, my sincere hope is that you will spend the rest of your lives being challenged by these precepts. Your body and mind knows how to live in adversity. That's how we got this far. It also knows how to calm that adversity. That's how we got this far. And so to enter into the profound implications of living a life consciously, joyfully, freely dedicated to wakefulness, to liberation, to truthfulness, these are not small things. In fact, I don't know of anything greater. And so in taking these vows, you will be challenged. In those moments of challenge, remember, this is what I asked for. This is what I was seeking. And enter into it and put it to service. Put it to work, which means put yourself to work. To awaken your mind, to open your heart, to bring forth that great magnanimity of Buddha mind and Avalokiteshvara. These precepts have been given to you and received by you today in the presence of the Sangha, people who care about you, who practice with you. You are now a living link in this great tradition. This is how we got this far. It is because of this that others will be able to come. Don't underestimate that, the importance of that. And so in that way, part of the implication is the obligation that we now have, that you have. And that's a freely given, freely received, and a joyful thing. In the moments when it seems burdensome, look again. So with these vows, your practice in life has changed. May your spiritual life continue to unfold. May they help to illuminate and bring forth all the good that is within you. May your life go well.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.